right now we see Orban is trying to do his best in order to bring the conflict in Ukraine to some sort of political settlement. He wrote an article in the Newsweek magazine. It says that NATO is approaching a watershed moment. Today, instead of peace, the agenda is the pursuit of war. It seems that China, together with Russia, with Belarus, Iran, in these countries are trying to make it some sort of military cooperation to show NATO that they're prepared for any sort of escalation. How do you see the changes that are happening right now?
There are several other points. And starting from your last point of the involvement of China, we have remember that the Americans threatened to intervene in favor of Taiwan and to provide new weapons to Taiwan. So the Chinese, basically, you have the US on the against China and the US against Russia, if you want. So China understands that they need a support, a political support at least, on the eastern side, and they have to return the favor to the Russians on the western side. So I think it's a very how to say that reckless attempt from the West to attack from two sides, a bloc and the Eurasian group bloc, which is mainly composed of Russia and China. You may include Belarus if you want, but mainly those two. And now they have joined their forces because they are facing the same threats. So you have the West threatening this bloc from two sides. So China has an immense reservoir of human resources and military human resources, I mean. So it's they try to demonstrate and to show the West that if you want to make war against us, we are in a better position to fight against you. First of all, because if you want to attack both of on the two sides, then the West would be divided. You have an eastern part, you have a western part, while on when you are in the center, in the middle, then you have a much more ability to use your forces rationally to counter this threat. So I think it's in this time where we declare an economic war against China, we threaten to support Taiwan, to provide weapons. Remember that providing weapons to Taiwan is, in fact, is basically excluded by the agreements that have been reached between China and the United States since the early 70s, because it's also worth reminding people that officially, and that is acknowledged by the US as well as the international community, Taiwan is part of China. And there is only one China. The difference between Taiwan and China being as to where the government sits. Does it sit in Taipei or does it sit in Beijing? This is where you have a difference. But both the Taiwanese and the Chinese agree that there is only one China and that Taiwan is part of this China. Therefore, when you send weapons to Taiwan, basically, it's as if the Russians were supplying weapons to Hawaii, or the Chinese would supply Chinese weapons to Hawaii, or if the Russians were supplying weapons to Corsica in France and all that. You know, this is exactly the same situation. So we see that again, the West is using the double standard even towards its own decision and own political decision. So that's one aspect. But now coming back to Viktor Orban, it's very striking, and I have mentioned that in all my books regarding the Ukrainian conflict, since we have this military intervention on the 24th of February 2022 by Russia. In fact, we see that the European Union, and here I would prefer to put forward the European Union rather than NATO, because NATO has absolutely no room for making decision in this conflict. NATO is only the armored arm of US, if you want. Whereas if you look at the European Union had its own leadership, and the European Union can make decisions. I mean, Ursula von der Leyen, for instance, she can make decisions. And you have a system that allows for making decision in support or of a peace process, or in support of delivering weapons to Ukraine, or in support of whatever. But they have a decision mechanism. NATO has not really such decision-making system. In fact, it works if the US doesn't want NATO to decide something, well, that's enough, because you need to have a consensus. And therefore, if one doesn't want, then everything is gone. While on the European side, you have kind of administrative type of decision making, meaning that Ursula von der Leyen doesn't really need to consult even countries to make some decisions. So that gives the European Union more flexibility. And that's the reason why, by the way, you have these, and we mentioned today there are probably between 20 and 30 different bilateral treaties between Ukraine and other countries, including a treaty between Ukraine and the European Union to have support. And the reason for these bilateral treaties to exist is simply because NATO cannot work in support of Ukraine, because NATO is essentially a nuclear alliances. The purpose of NATO is to bring Europeans under the nuclear umbrella of the US. That's the purpose of NATO. And for the rest, and in support of Ukraine, NATO is not the right tool for that. And therefore, they had to create a new tool, if you want, and these are those bilateral agreements between Ukraine and European countries. And that's it. So, but interestingly enough, despite the freedom of movement, if I can say, of the European Union, it's interesting to see that the European diplomacy has played absolutely no role whatsoever in the conflict. It's totally absent. By the way, it's also absent from the Palestinian conflict, by the way. You see, the Americans, I mean, the US diplomacy, I'm not sure it's very effective, but nevertheless, at least when things go wrong, people call Blinken. And the same on the Ukrainian side. Blinken is there, the State Department is there, but there is absolutely no question of any European position in support of any kind of process. I mean, yes, supporting process to Ukraine, but there is absolutely no role for the European Union in support of a peace process, for instance. Remember that before February 2022, you had the agreements, the Minsk agreement, that were supposed to solve the problem of the population of Donbas, and it was France and Germany that were supposed to guarantee to be the guarantors of the implementation of this agreement, but neither France nor Germany fulfilled their commitment, and they refused to made what they were supposed to do. And for that reason, we have the Russian intervention, which is, I remind you, the purpose of the Russian intervention is to protect the population of Donbas. And this protection should have been provided by the Minsk agreement. So even the European diplomacy was not able to make an incentive for Ukraine to implement the Minsk agreement. Therefore, before the conflict, the European diplomacy was not there. During the conflict, the European diplomacy is not there either. So you see that the only individuals and leaders who have tried to have some kind of influence on the conflict, where on the European continent you had Erdogan, the leader of Turkey, president of Turkey. He tried to mediate some agreement. By the way, he almost achieved a result in March, April 2022, as the agreement that was discussed between the Russian and Ukrainian almost reached the final signature. It was because of the Western countries that this couldn't happen, but that was under the auspices of Erdogan. And Erdogan tried another time in August 2022, and here again the UK came to say no, there will be no agreement. So we see that Erdogan tried its best. Viktor Orban could not do much as just leader of Hungary. But we have to remember that there is an Hungarian minority in Ukraine. And this minority is affected by the various laws and discriminatory laws adopted by Ukraine since 2014. And the Hungarian government has complained several times to the European Union and the Council of Europe to assist in solving the problem of the Hungarian minority in Ukraine. And that is probably the reason why Viktor Orban feels entitled to engage Ukraine in some kind of process, because it definitely may serve the peace at large in the region, but it may also serve the interests of the Hungarian minority and the Hungarian people who are concerned about what happens to their minority in Ukraine. So he has, in fact, two hats in this endeavor. And as far as I know, as Viktor Orban met Zelensky, he talked about this Hungarian minority. That's his foot in the door, if you want, to address the problem of Ukraine. But in addition to that, we know that Viktor Orban has always tried to have a more rational approach to this conflict, even before he was the head of the Council, the European Council, and the president of the European Council. And he tried to explain that the Europe should do more in favor of mediation in this conflict. Now he has a position in the European Union. In fact, he tries to take advantage of that. So he went to see Zelensky, then he went to see Vladimir Putin, the Chinese leadership, and the US leadership as well. So I think he has an idea, and at least I would say at least he does it, because so far nobody does it. And see how this the paradox, because just we just discussed this conference in Switzerland, this summit about peace, and everybody acknowledged that this summit was a failure because Russia was not invited. And even Zelensky himself last week recognized that he the next conference should include Russia. So in essence, Zelensky acknowledged the need to talk to the Russians. So th there is here a window of opportunity to address a dialogue with Russia and to open the dialogue that has not existed since the end of 2021. So everybody acknowledged the need for this dialogue. But as Viktor Orban goes to visit Vladimir Putin, he got only criticisms from his European counterparts. So it is a total contradiction with what Zelensky himself said. And that just shows that Europeans are not interested in having peace. And they want to fight against Russia. They still have in mind that the longer this war goes on, let's say, the more it will weaken Russia somehow. So in their view and in their interest, there is no interest in going towards peace. On the contrary, they want to prolong this war because they expect to have a weakening Russia. And nota bene, this just shows that they have absolutely no consideration whatsoever for Ukraine and the Ukrainian population. Because at the end of the day, the more this war goes on, the more the Ukrainian population will suffer. And it's not just rhetoric, because we see more and more in the Ukrainian press, and even in, we see that in probably more Anglo-Saxon press, that means what you see in the UK and in the US, not so much in Western Europe, but in the UK and US, you see more and more criticisms about the purpose or the rationale for prolonging this war. Because everybody, I mean, everybody who has some brain understands that the longer this war goes, the worse it is for the Ukrainians. They support the burden of this war. Because regardless of what you may think about Putin, the Russian armed forces, and Russia, the fact of the matter is that Russia is winning. Russia is winning, period. So that means that if you want to take this war longer, that would be at the cost of Ukrainians, Ukrainian territory, and at the end of the day, probably at the cost of even the mere existence of Ukraine. And remember, I've mentioned that a couple of times, but if you go back to this strategy outlined by the RAND Corporation in April 2019, which outlines the strategy is extending Russia, competing from advantageous ground or something like that. In any case, this 300 pages strategy that was aimed at weakening Russia by using Ukraine, in fact. And in this strategy, you see all what we have seen in the last couple of years in Ukraine. But the analysts of the RAND Corporation have clearly stated under the chapter risks that this strategy would cost to Ukraine a huge amount of human resources, we cost Ukraine the loss of territories, and we push Ukraine into unfavorable type of negotiation of peace. So we knew that from 2019, we knew that using Ukraine to weaken Russia is a wrong strategy, and that will be only be at the cost of Ukraine. So we know that the documents can be downloaded on the website of the RAND Corporation. Nothing new on that. Every leader in Europe should know that, but nevertheless, they still continue. So that means that they have an absolutely reckless approach to towards Ukraine. They consider that Ukraine is just expandable, and that's exactly what is going on. And basically, and that's the reason why Russia, in essence, is not in a hurry to have discussions, because as every day goes, Russia improves its position in Ukraine. And it's also, by the way, improves its position at large, because we see, and now the World Bank has just upgraded the situation of Russia, which is now a high income level country. So, meaning that the economy of Russia is working, the stability of Russia is works much even better than it was before. The popularity of Vladimir Putin is growing. The integration of Russia into the worldwide network, especially when I talk about the worldwide network, I'm talking about the global South and the network that is developing with China, India, Russia, and all that. This is developing. Russia is even more integrated than it was before in the international world. So I don't see why the West is so keen to keep this war going on. This goes against any kind of rational thinking, but that's the way it is. That's probably the reason why the leaders that we have in Europe have found so much disagreement recently during the European elections. But it shows the irrationality and the mediocrity of the Western leadership at large, in particular in Europe, which is extremely worrisome. And since the leaders in Europe understand that the situation will not improve, they have a more aggressive rhetoric towards Russia. And that's why people now speak about the possibility of war in Europe, that after Ukraine, Russia will attack Europe, which is absolutely baseless type of allegation. But nevertheless, that's the way Western leaders understand that. And we were talking about foreign policy of Europe. Josep Borrell was just now, he has been changed, and the new foreign minister of Europe will be Kaya Kallas, who is used to be the prime minister of Estonia, a 1.5 million country, so a very tiny country, which, by the way, is a recipient of a net recipient of European aid. If you look at the map, if you look at on the map of or the countries in Europe who receive aid from Europe, and those who provide what the provide money to Europe, you will see that all the ex communist countries or ex Warsaw Pact countries, I mean Eastern European countries, basically are net recipient of European aid, while the Western part of Europe is the part that provide fans to Europe, meaning that this Estonian country, which just receive aids from the rest of Europe, he's making a foreign policy, and Kaja Kallas is known to be extremely, extremely Russophobian. And in recent in a recent conference, by the way, she said that the what she expect the result from Russia is a decolonized Russia. I mean, Russia decompose in various smaller states, so that Russia, as we know, should not exist anymore. So that's the way the Europe is considering a foreign policy. How can we have a constructive foreign policy with a foreign minister like this? So it doesn't make any sense. And we see that the rhetoric is a rhetoric of war, basically, that Europe is developing. Again, I put more emphasis here on Europe rather than NATO. But NATO, of course, is more concerned about the consequences of being involved in the conflict, because, as I said, NATO is essentially a nuclear power, if I can put it bluntly. And they know what would be the consequence of engaging in an open conflict with Russia. And remember that even individual NATO countries have not been able to supply all the weapons that Ukraine was expecting to have in order to counter Russia. So, and we see, and we have reports that have been published, by the way, that European countries are not ready for a war. They are not ready in any way. The British armed forces are in a level of inefficiency that is dramatic. The same applies to the German armed forces. The same applies to France and all that. So as a result, I don't see NATO today has been keen to engage into an open war. And in fact, all the attempts to push NATO into a conflict in Ukraine, such as what Emmanuel Macron used to say to provide troops in support of Ukraine and all that has been countered by NATO. And even Jens Stoltenberg say, no, there's no plan to have any NATO involvement in Ukraine. And I think they realize that NATO has not the capacities and probably not even the capabilities to engage in a conflict against a reinforced Russian army with an army that is highly modernized, highly battle trained, and who have battle experience. I mean, none of the European countries, with the exception probably of France, has a recent war experience. And even though they don't have an experience on a battlefield such as Ukraine, they have an experience in counterinsurgency warfare, which is extremely different from what is going on in Ukraine. As a result, I'm not sure NATO is keen to engage into a war. I don't see that there is any incentive for European countries to send troops in Ukraine, and they will keep this, let's say, muscle flexing rhetoric, saying that they will do something, will support Ukraine, they fight against dictatorship and Putin and all that. They will certainly say so, but I'm not sure they will take concrete steps to do anything in that direction, because they don't have the means to do it. They don't have the capabilities and the capacities to do it. They don't have the industrial base to sustain a full-fledged war against Russia. So I don't think NATO is able to even play with this kind of rhetoric. In that If we consider that, then we can see that the presence of Chinese troops in exercise with Belarus is more like a political statement than effective deterrence or things like that. It's more like a statement saying, now we have linked all these countries from Belarus to Beijing. We have a link, we have bound those countries. We are ready to help each other in case of war. But remember, we have mentioned Viktor Orban, we have mentioned Recep Tayyip Erdogan, but we could have mentioned China because China is also a country that tried to provide a framework for a possible peace agreement between Ukraine and Russia in 2022. Even Zelensky considered asking China to mediate some kind of agreement between the two countries, and that was prevented by Western countries. But I mean, China is still considered by many observers as neutral, despite allegation that they provide microchips or whatever to Russia, which is kind of a rhetorical exercise. But in terms of wanting a mediation, China is an actor. Could be an actor, and China, I'm sure, could play this role in mediating between the Ukraine and Russia. The problem is that the West has antagonized China since the beginning of the special military operation. As a result, I'm not sure that the West would accept China in that role, but still, potentially speaking, China is an actor that could provide this role. It's by the way, they don't have a vested interest in that conflict. I mean, they are on the other side of the Eurasian continent, and they have all interests to have peace, in fact, and that they have stated that on a couple of occasions. So the problem, and regardless from which side we see the problem, we see that we have always the same problem, the same barriers. This is Europe, and to a lesser extent, I would say the US. The US today has understood that the conflict in Ukraine is lost. They don't want to lose face, so they keep their promise to support Ukraine, but we see that this support is slightly fading also because the US has not unlimited capacities to support Ukraine in there, and therefore the US would not be unhappy to have someone playing the role of intermediary or mediator to find a solution to this conflict, because they know that this conflict becomes a burden. It's no one in the West will gain anything from that. Russia has reacted in a way to this conflict which is totally opposed to what were the Western expectations. And therefore, everything we do and the more we wait, the better the position of Russia will be. So there is no reason to be against a political settlement. And so the US seems to have understood that, I mean, to some extent, also because of the presidential election and all the the polls that shows that Biden he's not so much has not so much popularity as he did. As a result, it's probably if he could achieve some success in in a negotiation or in a settlement of the conflict. That could be at least some kind of success. He might not have defeated Russia, but at least he could have achieved some kind of peace or something like that. That could be an achievement. So that's probably the view of the US establishment, even if there are some the US administration is divided on that aspect, especially in the State Department. But anyway, there's at least that. On the European side, on the other hand, we have only hardliners. And although there are some Viktor Orban and Fico in Slovakia who may join Viktor Orban in initiative to find a political settlement to the conflict. But beside this, you have only hardliners and people who don't dare to go backwards on their policy. They have failed on everything regarding Ukraine. They have failed in implementing the Minsk agreement. They have failed in advising Zelensky to find a solution in April or March, April 2022. They have failed in supporting Ukraine in an effective way. They have failed to provide Ukraine with an option for victory. And so this is a total failure if you look at the problem from a European point of view, if you are honest. But the problem is that the leadership, regardless of the country, I underline this, regardless of the country, is corrupt. And therefore, there is no chance we can achieve anything from corrupt government. We can just hope that individuals such as Viktor Orban or Fico can help the rest of Europe to be a little bit more realistic and have a more a sane approach to the conflict and try to have a rational solution to that conflict and have a political settlement rather than a military settlement, which would be, without any doubt, if it's a military settlement, it would be in favor of Russia. That's why I think if you don't want peace, that's fine. That would be in favor of Russia, but you have to understand that it will be that way. So those people who think, and you have some commentators in France in particular who still say there's some opportunities for Ukraine to achieve victory. I don't know exactly on which planet these guys are, because nobody has defined what could be a victory. We don't see exactly how they could achieve that victory. We don't see exactly which kind of resource they could achieve this victory. So this is just wishful thinking, and basically that's what the Europe is doing with Ukraine since, in fact, 2000 or 2014. In fact, that's the sad aspect of the reality.